Have you played the game of opposites before? Have you played the opposite game before? Anybody? No? Kids? Karenna? Nadia? You played the opposite game before? You know what the opposite game is? Okay. If you have kids, this game is actually one of your best friends. You're welcome in advance. Now, it's not tantrum proof, so don't think that it's tantrum proof, but it'll buy you some mileage. But here's how you play the opposite game. It really is quite simple. The way we're going to play it today is we're going to show you pictures, and we're going to see if you can guess what the opposite is, okay? And you can keep track of about how many you can match up, okay? So we're going to start off with a relatively easy one first. Let's see what we got up there. Big. What do you think the opposite of big is? What? Small? Did they get it right? Oh, little. Okay, so you're on the right track. Big, little. Okay, opposites. Okay, what's our next one? Loud. What's the opposite of loud? Soft or quiet. Let's see. Quiet. Shh. Okay, what's our next one? Yes. What's the opposite of yes? It's no. Okay, you're very firm in that one. That's a good one. We've known that one for a while. What about slow? What's the opposite of fast, right? Okay, is it yes? Absolutely. Ah, tortoise in the hair, okay. And tall, what's the opposite of tall? Short, okay. Very good, you got that one right. Opposite of hot? Ah, cold, okay. And the opposite of day? Night. Okay, so how do you think you did? Did you give yourself a grade? Some of you looked a little nervous, like you weren't really sure. If you want to take a test on Sabbath, everything's fine. We're in the house of the Lord, so you're good. Did you do okay? Now, another question for you, so the quiz continues. Where did you learn about opposites? Can you think on that? Where was the first time that you learned about opposites? We had a healthy choir of answers, so most of us, I'm going to guess, didn't just learn that today, unless you're five and under. You've probably had exposure to it, right? So can you think of how young you were when the opposite game actually became more than just a game and actually the way that we did life, the way that we do life? Barbara Brown Taylor, an author of the book of Learning to Walk in the Dark, talks about this very idea in her opening chapter. She titles the chapter, Who's Afraid of the Dark? And as I read this chapter, I took a trip on my own down memory lane as I tried to figure out when it was that I had first learned to be afraid of the dark. And I'm not sure at what age I can say this actually changed or even why, because like Barbara Brown Taylor, when I was a kid, hanging out in the desert nights of Little Rock, yes, one word, yes, in California, it was usual for you to drive by the Maravilla home and find a line of us sprawled on the driveway floor, on the warm cement, especially on summer nights. And in the dark, we would just lay there and we would stargaze. Perfect. Little Rock isn't really known for much, but one thing that you can do out in Little Rock is stargaze, and it is a stunning sight. But in that time, we did anything but be afraid of the dark. But nonetheless, it did happen, right? And at one point, it did happen for me or to me. I'm not really sure what order that is in. But there was a day when darkness was no longer a safe space. And I will tell you that it wasn't until I was about 19, maybe 20, when I was walking in the backyard in the dark of my apartment, when I was a student missionary in Majuro, that I dared to just stand in the darkness in the name of understanding what the fuss was all about. Was it really all in my head, or was it actually something that is going to justify why I was so spooked and why I had this feeling in my gut every time I walked alone in the dark, or why my skin crawled when I was scared and I was walking alone, or was it all just really in my mind? Was it real, or was it something that was just happening in my mind? Where did I learn this? Pastor Chris introduced us to this theme from Barbara Brown Taylor. Her book, Darkness, both physical and metaphorical, is not something that we get over. But darkness, both physical and metaphorical, is something we get through. As we continue in the season of Easter, we find ourselves on the other side of the resurrection, the opposite side, if you will. There is a story to tell, we heard over and over from our choir, university choir, during the 4 days with Jesus. There was a story to tell, and there is a story to tell. But what exactly is that story? Many of you shared with several of the pastoral staff that there was much about the weekend that was quite unsettling for you. Quite unsettling 4 days spending with Jesus. And we already knew this. We knew this was going to happen because we know the storyline from the Last Supper to the crucifixion and then finally waiting in silence as Jesus lay dead in the tomb. We know this because the story hasn't changed. Every year we remember the same story, right? Nonetheless, every year, everyone's favorite part, as many of you have voiced, is Sunday. Pastor Bev! That's what your kids usually, it's a little song that they do. Pastor Bev! But Sunday's the resurrection of Jesus! Yes, I know, but you see, it wasn't just the adults who were unsettled. In fact, the children were also quite unsettled. They too asked several questions of your pastoral staff. Why is it so dark in here? And when are we going to turn the lights on? We got from several children. If you missed 4 days with Jesus with us last weekend, you are welcome to visit our church webpage, and or you can go to 4dayswithjesus.com, and you can understand a little bit more in depth what our fuss is all about of the darkness. But we made it through the darkness, didn't we? Alas, here we are. We made it through Silent Sabbath, and we arrived just as everyone anticipated to Resurrection Sunday, and Resurrection Sunday came and we sang songs and we filled our stage with beautiful flowers and we ate pancakes. That alone can get one to say hallelujah, right? We talked to one another and we enjoyed the sweet light of a perfectly sunny Easter Sunday in Southern California. And although it would be exciting to leave the story there, that with that happily ever after-like ending, even the author of Matthew, as the Davises read for us this morning, knows that it is not where the story ends. There is more, and brace yourself, because you might not actually like this part as we read it more closely. Of the four Gospels, Matthew is unique in that there are four verses that almost seem completely out of place to me, sticking out like a sore thumb. And if you're all about that resurrection celebration, then you won't really like these four verses we read today, because they kind of rain all over the resurrection parade. That's what it seems like. And after the silent night of Jesus' death, Mary and Mary walk to the tomb where Jesus' body lay, and on their way there was an earthquake. And I imagine that they got there, and once they saw that the stone had been rolled over and the tomb was open, in an instant there was this devastation that they felt both physically and spiritually and mentally all over. After a long week of already devastating events, now this, can you imagine being Mary or Mary? As they arrive at the tomb site, it seems they're not the only ones who decided to be up in the early morning by this graveside. The guards, we know, who were working, right, were already there. And what scares the almost literal living daylights out of the day of the guards is the arrival of an angel. Verse 4 of chapter 28 says, "For the fear of the angels, the guards shook, and they became like dead men themselves." They passed out, in short. The angel offers Mary and Mary a word of hope and resurrection. The angel says, "Do not be afraid." And we're familiar with this phrase, "Do not be afraid." So Mary and Mary run off to tell the disciples what they have witnessed. And on their way there, Jesus meets them. And again, Jesus affirms not just what the angel had said to them, but what Jesus has been saying to them over and over again. Do not be afraid. Here is the part that we often miss, though, since we are so excited to rush past to the Great Commission, that verse in verse 16 of chapter 28, right? We just want to fly right past it. When the guards eventually do wake up, they run to tell the chief priests, their boss. The chief priests and the elders of the church, they decide that the story of Jesus needs a little help ending because it had a little bit of a trouble. Right? And that they had a quick fix to it. All they had to do for the right price was tell the governor that the disciples of Jesus came to the tomb and stole the body while they were asleep. I can't imagine why you would want to do yourself in, because you are suggesting this is the kind of guard you are, but nonetheless, this is what happens. The guards agree and they take the bribe and they agree to alter the truth of what happened in the tomb. In the name of keeping the governor satisfied, these soldiers follow commands to alter the story as if it was not good enough to stand on its own. Two different stories at the tomb. Just hours after the night is becoming day, and they walk away in such different, distinct experiences, distinct conclusions. Both driven by fear, it is clear from the scene that even after the resurrection, stories continue, and there is still so much commotion happening in the world. This week, participating in a two-hour homeless simulation project that students from the university worked on with our own Marnie Strain here and Daphne Thomas, where I got to participate for 2 hours, I played the role of a 14-year-old girl. This was my given profile. 14-year-old girl who lived in a small apartment here somewhere in Riverside, with her 17-year-old brother, who had impregnated a young girl, and with her mother, who was currently jobless, and with no father because he had recently walked away from them. What they had to work with, and what we had for our simulation project for the next 2 hours, was $10. We were given $10. This is what you have to survive on for the next 2 days, which actually was a symbol of the next 6 months of an average person's life. $10 to pay the rent, it needs to be enough for utilities, and it needs to be enough for food for 3 people. It was clear to me that although only a few days had just passed since we witnessed this moment of resurrection of Jesus that Sunday, there was still this sense of dimness in the world. It was a loud dimness. And though we had sung songs on Sundays and we shared communion, there were many families just like the one I played for a mere 2 hours, knowing that they had to go day in and day out wondering where their next meal was gonna come from. This was their every day. And although we made crafts with the kids, fun projects, we shared a morning with goodness together, and when it was all said and done, even some of us here had a different reality to go back to, didn't we? We had to go back to our homes, where there we would be nursing illness, where there we would be nursing and attending to damaged and fragile relationships, right? You went back to mourning the loss of loved ones that you've lost, whether it was this past weekend, this past month, this season, it is all still so fresh. You went back to figuring out how you were going to make it financially this week. We went back to jobs that are not fulfilling to us. We went back to a world of racism, of sexism, of prejudice, of abuse, and the list can go on, right? We went back to a reality that we still live in a world where fear casts a very dark shadow and where we are reminded that we are very much still afraid of the dark. There is something unique about this week's reading. Matthew, perhaps not directly pointing to us, to the darkness, is signaling that we need to take the time to learn to walk through the darkness. While this is a significant few verses snapping us back into reality, it is also a powerful reminder that the world, though it might seem split into this dualistic view of opposites, good versus bad, like our game early on, it is still God's world. And it is still, more importantly, God's story. Working with children, I've learned something. I've learned that it is less helpful to try to create a quick fix for kiddos, especially for problems that we consider problems, like the dark. Children are not really interested in quick fixes, right? They are interested in understanding, and as they are growing, all too often our frustration in our world as adults, it becomes so overwhelming that we become exhausted by the why period that kids go through. If you have little ones, you know, right? There is a time when everything is about the why. Why? I don't know. Why? I don't know. And you start off with nice answers, but gradually you get frustrated with why, because you just don't know. And so then we settle for cheap answers like, well, because. And then the greatest one is because I said so. Huh. Well, these really are quick fixes, right? Because they really only feed the why machine to then wonder, well, why? Why only because you say so? The reason I know this is because I was that child. Don't say because I said so. Great. Well, why do you get to say so, right? Although a quick fix might seem economical at that time, it's much more expensive in the long run because the price tag is one quick fix after another, and after a while, it adds up. My notion is that tucked into these quick fixes were this is where fear leaks into our lives, and then 20 years later, we are sending our kids to counselors and therapists to deal. But the world cannot spend or depend solely on therapists, can we? Or counselors, can we? Mary and Mary, in their moment, needed much more than a quick fix answer. And that morning, during that resurrection, they needed reassurance that the darkness of the prior night was not dominated by fear. Eugene Peterson, in his book, Living the Resurrection, speaks of two kinds of fear. One kind of fear, he says, he describes as displayed and lived by the guards, and I would add the chief priests and the elders, was a fear that incapacitates us for dealing with God, dealing with Jesus. But then there is a different kind of fear, that which Mary and Mary embraced. It's a fear that pulls us out of the preoccupation with ourselves. It is a fear that pulls us out of our own feelings, our circumstances, and into a world of great wonder. It pulls us into the very action of God. And so the darkness, maybe it is to be feared, but a fear that pulls us into a deeper wonder with God, for God, it is not a darkness to be feared at all. For God is in the darkness, and the darkness belongs to God, and for God is the creator of the world, and all things belong to God. So, as you've been thinking, as you've been listening, have you put your finger on it yet? When did you become fearful of the dark? When fear became the lens through which we tell our stories, right? It's a tough task, though, isn't it? The longer we have lived, the more memories we have to leaf through. I don't know, how long ago was it? I knew this gal in undergrad when I was an RA at the university who had a pretty strong fear of the dark. And she walked with a flashlight on her keychain wherever she went so that she would never be caught off guard. And when she walked through the halls of her house or the dorm at one point when she was there, She would turn on every single light that she could find. And that's how she got through the halls in the house at night. And if there were no light switches or no light for her to light the path or to illuminate the room in which she walked in, she wouldn't go into that room until there was. But more often than not, she carried her handy flashlight tucked away in her pocket, and so her fear was less visible, and it was portrayed as her always being prepared for any situation, right? She dated sparingly, and she had a really small group of friends because it was just too hard and too difficult, and there were too many moments where she felt like she just didn't want to explain what was happening with her. And she would rather just not participate. She didn't want to go through the trouble of talking about how she didn't want to watch a movie in the dark or how she didn't want to walk in the park in the moonlight. No, she was afraid of the dark, and as time passed, it was something that she started to become ashamed of. Barbara Brown Taylor would refer to this as a darkness disability. This gal was both afraid and ashamed of her darkness disability. She could never put her finger on why, though. She said that her parents didn't know how to help her. They couldn't figure out why. And so what they taught her to do was a quick fix, was just carry a flashlight with you wherever you go, or a nightlight or something. Just, you'll have this light. So if you get scared, you just turn the light on. And it wasn't until close to the end of her time here at the university in her undergrad that she had this moment where the lights in her neighborhood went out. And she was nowhere near her keys or the safety of her light keychain. And she was forced, like Jacob, to wrestle in the darkness with the dark. And she sat frozen, gripping the pillows around her and the blankets around her so tight that her hands began to cramp and they were sore. And she said that after what seemed like a decade of darkness, there in the middle of the silence, in the absence of the light, she began to remember these snapshots of her childhood where a man would walk into her bedroom and in the darkness, forever violating her trust and safety of the dark. As a young girl, she didn't know that she could say anything after the first time that it happened because it was a family member who visited often who created this space. And every time he walked into her room, she knew what was going to happen. And so she would shut her eyes and she would close tight so that she didn't have to face the darkness. And for over a year, she said that this happened until that family member finally moved away and it just became easier to let it go, to just block it out. But it remained in the shadows of her mind and in the shadows of her past. And for the first time in her life, that night, in her early 20s now, she understood something different about the darkness, that the darkness was not scary, the darkness was not dangerous, it was not all of the things that she would have imagined they were and the way that she would let her imagination run wild and make her believe. The darkness helped her through one of the most traumatic times of her young life. Her story for so long had been about what the darkness was, that she never thought to understand what the darkness was not. I don't think these verses in Matthew are pointing us to quick fixes, but I do think that they jolt us back into this reality that all too often we can be quick to use the resurrection as this quick fix to all of life's problems. All too often we want to get to Sunday, the day of light, right? But we run the risk of losing all meaning of this entire story if we don't allow room for the darkness. The angel says to the women what Jesus has repeated throughout the Gospels over and over again, do not be afraid. Jesus is not claiming that we will never have anything, we will never not be afraid of anything, right? But that we can trust that Jesus himself has laid in and through the darkness, the darkest of dark. And Jesus knows what lives in the darkness, and it is still God's story. Barbara Brown Taylor suggests we cannot live in a world interpreted for us by others, because an interpreted world is not hope. Jesus commissions Mary and Mary first to go and to tell this. This is the story of what the resurrection is not. It is not the end of a story, and it is not to override all the parts of the rest of the story. We get through the darkness, Jesus is claiming, because this is part of the story where we witness faith in motion. This is also not a sermon, whether the guards or the chief priests or the elders were wrong. This is not a reason to justify and crucify the Jews, and how could they not have seen what the truth was? We don't need to spend time and or our energy in that direction, because God makes sure that God's story comes through, and that's what we need to focus on, what the story is. Nonetheless, talking about what happened is important, because in voicing the story, we can learn about what makes us afraid, and when we can name what drives our fears, then we make room for God's story to take place more fully, and the light is beautiful, but so is the darkness. In what ways can we live differently from this moment on, now that we have been exposed to the light and the darkness? I think for each of us, it's going to be different, because each of our fears are so unique to us. But if we are to live this cruciformed life that we have been talking about here in this very sanctuary, then a life transformed by the life of Jesus, by the death of Jesus, and then by the life again of Jesus, then we have to spend some time in the absence of light. But never, friends, mistaken that for the absence of Jesus. I think that when I have children, this is what I want to teach them. I think I want to focus on the faith of the story and the faith in the story of God, and less on the story of fear. Until then, I think I'm going to make time and find space again to do what I did as a child, to find some warm cement in a safe space where I can go and lay vulnerable and have access to the only place where we can have access to the story of the stars, in the ever sacred space of the darkness of the night. Let's pray. God, you are good. And we ask that with this beautiful story of both day and night, God, may we go living fully in our story, in the light and in the dark, and telling fully the story of the life of Jesus, the death of Jesus, and the resurrection of Jesus. We sing, God, hallelujah, because it is in Jesus who we find life. Jesus, who overcomes myths of darkness, we do not need to be afraid. Amen.